Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So yesterday at the end of the show, we played the highlights from President Zelensky's address to Congress, asking for planes, that if you're not going to give me a no-fly zone, which is really what he wants, close the skies. Of course,
humanitarian aid, he wanted that too.
Of course, that met with a response from the administration almost immediately. Here's what Biden said he will do: $800 million more of weaponry.
Saturday, my administration authorized another $200 million to keep a steady flow of weapons and ammunition moving to Ukraine. Now I'm once again using my presidential authority to activate an additional security assistance to continue to help Ukraine fend off Russia's assault, an additional $800 million in assistance. That brings the total of new U.S. security assistance to Ukraine to $1 billion just this week. These are direct transfers of equipment from our Department of Defense to the Ukrainian military to help them as they fight against this invasion. And I thank the Congress for appropriating these funds. This new package on its own is going to provide unprecedented assistance to Ukraine. It includes 800 anti-aircraft systems to make sure the Ukrainian military can continue to stop the planes and helicopters that have been attacking their people and to defend their Ukrainian airspace. And at the request of President Zelensky, we have identified and are helping Ukraine acquire additional longer-range anti-aircraft systems and the munitions for those systems. Our new assistance package also includes 9,000 anti-armor systems. These are portable, high accuracy shoulder-mounted missiles that the Ukrainian forces have been using with great effect to destroy invading tanks and armored vehicles. It'll include 7,000 small arms, machine guns, shotguns, grenade launchers to equip the Ukrainians, including the brave women and men who are defending their cities as civilians, and they're on the countryside as well. And as well as the ammunition, artillery, and mortar rounds to go with small arms, 20 million rounds in total, 20 million rounds. And this will include drones, which demonstrates our commitment to sending our most cutting-edge systems to Ukraine for its defense.
So you get the whole grocery list full of different weapons that are going to be sent over. And, of course, there's a lot of focus on, well, why weren't they sent over earlier? Intel that provides, U.S. providing intel to Ukraine with respect to Russian operations. Why not intelligence on some of Putin's civilian targets? But pull back and ask the bigger question, contemplate the bigger question. Should the United States be focusing on pushing Ukraine to victory? Is that achievable? Give Zelensky what he wants. He knows what the deal is on the ground. Ukraine can win this thing. We should be pushing for victory and nothing short of ultimately deposing or facilitating the end of the Putin era in Russia? Or should we be focused on a ceasefire? Should we be focused on ending this? Should we be focused on a compromise position that, you know, Lavrov, the foreign minister for Putin, has said they're close to?
Well, what does a compromise look like?
Well, it does a compromise. We pull back to the Donbass region and you concede that those so-called breakaway republics, who, by the way, when there was a referendum, voted to stay with Ukraine. So the breakaway republic thing is very much in question. That's, of course, the characterization of the Russians. You recognize Crimea. You cede whatever Russia describes as self-determination in those breakaway republics, and that's it.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. More people are going to die. What do they say now? 7,000 plus Russian soldiers are dead too as well. Who knows? The fog of war, I guess.
The range on these body counts is so wide, it's really hard to know. But there's no question about the carnage. But the larger question is, what do we think we can accomplish here? Because I got to say, this gives Zelensky whatever he wants. Again, empathetic with his position of trying to do everything he can and get everything he can from everybody he can to repel the Russian invaders. But, you know, our interests are broader than that and more focused on America's national security interests. So are we deluding ourselves? Are we going down a primrose path for political reasons? The being whipped into frenzy by the communication stylings of Zelensky to do things that actually are increasing the body count without doing anything to ultimately alter the outcome here.
But aren't you afraid that if we give Putin, or not we, if Zelensky gives Putin certain territories, that then he'll want more, then he'll want the rest of Ukraine eventually, and then he'll want Poland, and then he'll want the surrounding countries?
Well, if you are right now laying siege to the entirety of Ukraine and your fallback position is to the Donbass region, the eastern part of Ukraine, it seems that would stunt your desire for the all of Ukraine and the entirety of Ukraine. And maybe Putin never wanted it in the first place. Maybe he just wanted the Donbass region, but because of the weakness of Western leaders and because of the resistance of Ukraine, he decided to take it all. If you're going to give it to me, I'll take it. The Ukrainians aren't giving it to him, but perhaps he perceived the West would. And the Ukrainians wouldn't put up the fight that they have put up. Perhaps. These are all perhapses. I mean, I go back to what Walter Russell Mead wrote this week in the Journal about weak Western leadership that Putin takes advantage of. And the comparison he made was to Mussolini in World War II. Weak Western leaders that Mussolini took advantage of. But at the end of the day, Mussolini's grand visions, like Mead argues, Putin's grand visions are not achievable because he just doesn't have the capacity. He hasn't built the capacity, particularly economic, to achieve the reassemblage of the Soviet Union. So, yeah, it seems like there's a real push on right now from the press corps, maybe providing cover for the political ruling class, from the TV diplomats who remind me very much of the TV doctors during COVID.
Right. They're all experts now. How quickly the left went from COVID now to fly zones. You know, in Ukraine, we support Ukraine 100%.
Well, it's not that they're all experts, but they all have the same position.
Yeah.
The ones on TV, we talked about this yesterday. So Mike McFaul, Obama's ambassador to Russia, is all over the place all the time. And he is Zelensky whatever he wants. But you had some 6 or 7 dozen diplomats who have all the credentials and more of a Mike McFaul, who now is, you know, resides in the ivory tower over at Stanford, saying no on the no-fly zone, signed a joint letter that we discussed yesterday. But that's not getting nearly the airtime, or does not generate nearly the enthusiasm that the Zelensky is a hero and we should give him whatever we want. I mean, let's maybe pull back a little bit and just decide. I get that Zelensky versus Putin. Putin is the aggressor. Putin is the war criminal. Zelensky is trying to along with his countrymen, repel a foreign invader. Okay. But that doesn't make Zelensky George Washington. It doesn't make Zelensky Winston Churchill. This idea, these are like permanent good guys and permanent bad guys. I just wonder if people get the sense that this is being way oversold in favor of Zelensky. Give me an example. Here's what the aforesaid Mike McFaul said yesterday.
I think he will go down in history as a heroic figure. What about listening to him rather than we pretend that we know what he needs? What about if he thinks he needs these weapons? Why don't we listen to him? And when we say, oh, they'll be shut down. Oh, he doesn't have airports to put those MiGs in. What about listening to his judgment to help him fight the war that he after all, is the one fighting the war. We're not fighting it. And I hope when he speaks to the American people, we'll say, okay, let's trust his judgment because he's the guy sitting in the bunker in Kiev. He's not in New York. He's not in D.C. He's not sitting out here in Palo Alto like I am. Let's trust his judgment at this critical moment in the history of his country.
Well, we'll be caring.
Yeah, because it's our stuff. And because it's our interests at stake. And because it's more complicated than Zelensky's understandable but narrow desire to salvage his administration and at least some of his country.
Right.
That's why you don't just say, whatever, Zelensky's judgment. I mean, you know, pardon me, excuse me. He's a few years removed from being a comedian and the voice of Teddy Ruxpin or Berenstain Bear or something in Ukraine. What the hell?
Berenstain Bear, yeah. Oh, and his Netflix series, or Netflix is now going to release his series that he made in 2019 as an actor.
Whatever. And so, I mean, I appreciate the position that he's in.
Yeah, he's desperate. I mean, he's going to do what he's going to do. He's going to try and tug at the hearts of American and lawmakers yesterday by saying, you know, what happened to you September 11th is happening to us every day for the past 3 weeks.
Right. But whose judgment? We're going to cede any judgments we make to Zelensky because he's on the ground there? No, I don't think so. What is this? We're outsourcing our decisions about military operations in Eastern Europe to Zelensky? We're just going to... That's a former ambassador to Russia. A U.S. ambassador to Russia saying that. That makes no sense to me.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Nick, Northwest Side.
Thank you. Good morning, people. The time to give the weapons appropriately would have been when Ukraine was surrounded on three sides, because that was before the Russian soldiers actually were getting in. Now you got rubble all over the place, bombs blowing up all over the place. I don't understand why they just took Putin's word for that. Then he promised and gave his word he's not going to attack Ukraine, if we remember that. And then all of a sudden he did. And then I was going to say also that all these sanctions and stuff, they got to maintain these things and keep going with them. They can't make it too rough on the Russian people, or else if people get desperate and feel they have no choice but to support the person that they have, which is Putin, that's what they'll do. But as long as they make things uncomfortable and miserable for several years, until maybe Putin get pushed out and other people will think in the government that they got to be more careful how they make moves on surrounding countries, because it might come back against them and affect their ability to stay in power. So
thanks for the call, Nick. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, continuing all week with the help of CWB Chicago, and they've designated the week, so we're just falling in line here. Electronic Monitoring Appreciation Week. We've got a couple of news stories to share, but before we get to that,
still makes me laugh.
Jussie Smollett released yesterday.
Oh my God!
Per a emergency appeal of his conviction, he is released on $150,000 bond, but he doesn't have to post any of it.
Yeah. And part of that is because remember, he originally, the charges were dropped if he agreed to pay the fine per Kim Fox's agreement with him.
Dan Webb, who's apparently a good guy now. The city. Dan Webb's a good guy.
Well, he was a bad guy. Now he's a good guy. Yeah.
He's a good guy.
This guy,
when he was U.S. attorney, couldn't find corruption anywhere in the city.
But now he's
that Dan Webb, because he's a special prosecutor of the Jussie Smollett case. Now he's Elliot Ness. Okay. Sure. Yeah. Dan Webb said there was no emergency that warrants the extraordinary relief of staying the sentence. Yeah, you know, you can appeal your sentence upon your conviction and your sentencing, but normally you do so while you're serving it.
Right. Well, they said the appeal process would take longer than the sentence itself. That's why the judge or the Illinois appellate court decided to let him out on bond while they're appealing it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, not really.
Okay.
I'm with Dan Webb on this one. No, there's no reason for him to be released. He should start serving his sentence, and that's up to the Illinois appellate court to move with all due speed so that they can resolve the matter, adjudicate the matter. So, no, that doesn't make any sense to me. So, you know, just a heads up that Jussie Smollett is out. So if there is any crimes that are alleged...
Oh, you mean alleged hate crimes, Dan? Some MAGA country stuff going on
down
here?
That's right. And if anybody, you know, in the next couple of weeks you hear is alleging that there are Trump voters roaming around committing hate crimes against Hollywood actors, just a heads up, Jussie Smollett is on the street.
Okay, well, here is his valiant release from prison.
Free.
Jussie, talk to me.
How does it feel to be free? Can you tell us what the past week has been like?
Jussie,
do you have anything to say to the judge?
Jussie, no, don't go.
And he was. What was that?
Well, that's the reporter standing outside of 26 and Cal when he was released from prison.
I know what that is. What the hell is that? That you call that a reporter?
No, that's reporter trying to get Jussie to stop to talk to them because apparently
you call that
for the past.
You call that journalism?
No, that's TMZ stuff.
Yeah. Right.
But as a reporter, you try to get the subject to stop to talk because apparently he hasn't been eating for 6 days and just chewing on ice chips.
What separates us in the jail because of COVID is the glass, and he pushed his hands on the glass and his eyes got teary. And I've never seen that because he's been very strong in there. And he said, I nearly lost hope in our constitutional system.
Oh, no.
Yeah, like he really said, I lost faith in our constitutional system. Here's his other attorney, because he has seven attorneys.
I think we're here because the appellate court realized this was the right thing to do. I hope everyone realizes that the persecution that went on in that courthouse was absurd.
Because they're still upset that the judge grandstanded, they say, for 40 minutes about the person, you know, that Jussie, you did this to yourself, that the judge reprimanded him and then sentenced him to 5 months in jail.
Hmm. Well, I hope Jussie can learn to love our constitutional system again at some point. I know this is a difficult breakup.
And he's either going to New York or L.A., so he will not be staying in Chicago.
Whew, could not care less about Jussie Smollett and where he ends up. Just thought I'd put the heads,
yeah.
You know, put the APB out in case there are alleged hate crimes committed by Trump voters, by alleged Trump voters. So. That's really about it. And also the folly of Dan Webb, who's now being lionized. I mean, I guess he was always lionized, but just remember who Dan Webb is, since the city has no institutional memory, at least as a I remember him. He's been around for a while. But I mean, no institutional memory in terms of actual conduct, work product, record. Dan Webb is the hero in this story. Wow. Okay. Electronic monitoring
appreciation week. Hey, do we have a song for it yet? Or are we just, it's already Thursday. So
yeah, it's only a week.
Our week's almost over.
They may be able to make it a month with the way this is going. I'll start.
Okay.
A 16-year-old and 21-year-old who fatally shot a man inside a West Garfield Park laundromat last summer, both awaiting both waiting trials for felony charges at the time of the murder. The juvenile was supposed to be on electronic monitoring, and accused man on bail for a gun charge had been convicted of murdering a 15-year-old as a juvenile. So he was on electronic monitoring. He is awaiting trial for murder inside a laundromat, and he was on electronic monitoring despite having the murder of a 15-year-old in his background as a juvenile.
Dear Lord. I mean, again, you cannot make this stuff up.
The two men charged with killing a guy at this laundromat in West Garfield Park represent the 69th and 70th persons charged with killing or shooting or trying to shoot or kill someone in Chicago in 2021 while awaiting trial for a felony. Another electronic monitoring success story. 70 people last year. So far, we keep finding new ones, or CWB does, to be more accurate. 70 people charged with killing or shooting or trying to kill or shoot someone in Chicago while awaiting trial for a felony. In this case, again, a guy who was convicted of murdering a 15-year-old as a juvenile, charged with murdering, participating with another guy, murdering a man inside a West Garfield Park laundromat, and was on electronic monitoring. Waiting for a trial for felony charges. Waiting for another trial on another trial with felony charges. It's just, okay.
Well, let me introduce you to Jorge Tenorio. Until a couple of days ago, Dan, he was on electronic monitoring for a serious gun case that he picked up while federal and local law enforcement raided his home in August 2020. While he was on electric monitoring for another gun case and on probation for two other felonies. He's not on electronic monitoring anymore because on yesterday, prosecutors charged him with forgery for allegedly creating a fake employment verification letter so he could get permission to move around town while on house arrest. So he's now making up documents so that he can move around while he's on electronic monitoring as a reason to get out of electronic monitoring and home arrest.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's back in the clink. But in August, when they raided his house, the FBI and DEA, Homeland Security, they were looking for a specific gun, and they found weapons, a loaded handgun under his bed that he and his girlfriend were lying on, a bulletproof vest in the bedroom closet, ammunition scattered throughout the house, a pistol in the living room. So, yeah, not a good guy, and they should have taken him in August of 2020. But he's been out on the streets since then. And Lord knows what crimes he's created and gotten away with.
Yeah, you know, we just share the stories so you know, because there's nothing anybody wants to do about it here, so I can find at this point. University of Chicago Booth School of Business. Each spring, they have a keynote lecturer at their management conference.
Oh, boy, who is it this year?
Clyde Stewart, writing about it at ChicagoContrarian.com. Goes to it every year for the last, or he said, rarely missed it over the past couple of decades. I was shocked and dismayed to see the keynote speaker this spring will be Mayor Lori Lightfoot, who is slated to address the future of business in Chicago.
I might want to attend that one.
Clyde Stewart writing a bit about this. Aside from rising crime in Chicago's poorly performing schools, let's talk about business in general. Chicago Bears are abandoning the city.
Oh, that's right.
The Mag Mile is continuing to suffer the loss of business and has failed to even attract a Target store.
Have you driven down there? I mean, can you imagine? Can you see what's going on?
Yeah, I've walked down Michigan Avenue. The Conrad Hilton is being foreclosed.
Oh.
The decline of the Hilton joins the demise of the Palmer House. Tax receipts from the hotel industry are down some $30 million. In three areas where Lightfoot's control in the three areas within Lightfoot's control that have a bearing on the future of business in Chicago, public safety, education, and fostering a business-friendly environment, you would be hard-pressed to find any business leaders who would give Lightfoot a higher grade than D-. And then he goes into her management skills and her abrasiveness, to be generous. You know, it's interesting because just reading this piece from Mr. Stewart reminded me of this talk I gave. This was after Lightfoot was elected in 2019. So this would have been like Christmas time of 2019.
Feels like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And where were you? What did you say?
So this is, I was invited, this guy from Morgan Stanley puts together this luncheon at Chicago Cut every year, or was doing it up until the pandemic. I don't know if he still is. And every year they bring in a speaker to talk basically about the state of the state and city. And you got a bunch of business types, you know, a lot of financial services people, but successful people from a lot of different walks of life and business in Chicagoland. And I was talking through where the city and the state are and how we live in 2019, that we live in the worst governed city in America in the worst governed state in American history. So it wasn't exactly, you know, a mindless happy talk that a lot of these guys are used to and not only hearing, but also perpetuating. And as I'm going through it, you know, I made some reference to Lightfoot's stature. I think I referenced Tiny Dancer, you know, Rahm outgoing, and Triple Threat incoming, and so on and so forth. This guy stands up, and he's you know, it's like, you know, just stick on the substance. Just stick on the substance. I mean, there's no need for the name calling. There's no need for the ridicule. Just stick on the substance. You know, we don't know yet. You know, you need to give people a chance. It's 9 months in at that point, 8 months in, not even 7 months in. And I just thought it was so interesting. And I responded, as you would expect, I would respond to give him, you know, my little speech about the importance of ridicule. But it just was so emblematic of how sheepish and pathetic and ill-informed and disingenuous the business community, such as it is in Chicago, is. These people that gather for lunches like that, whether it's at the City Club, which is basically, I mean, that's all like, you know, government workers and people in the government sector. Live off the government in one form or another, mainly. And that would include media and that, state-owned media, which de facto is. But then also the, you know, the money changers at Chicago Cut as well. How pathetic and disingenuous so many of them are. You know, very different people have a different collection of those characteristics I'm describing. They will not say what they know to be true. They will defer and continue to give the benefit of the doubt to people they know they would never hire. They will continue to pretend things in the city aren't the way they are, because basically the way that it's set up is okay for them. It works okay. I got a nice pad in Lincoln Park, or a nice condo at one of the she buildings in the Gold Coast or River North. So, yeah, that's fine. I get to enjoy the restaurants. I mean, again, now this is pre-pandemic. Some attitudes may have changed. But some, I guarantee you, will have not. The Economic Club of Chicago types, too. Same thing. They're all going to get together at a board meeting at the Civic Fed or the BGA, and they're going to fix things. You know, just on the margins where they need it. They're going to work constructively because they're deep thinkers. They're policy oriented. No, they're not. They're cowards. Many of them are rent-seeking hacks. They fold at the first sign of confrontation with anybody with any sort of city or state power. Genuflect before the feudal lord du jour in their ward, and of course anybody from the fifth floor. Yuck it up at Maggiano's or Chicago Cut with the grifters, the professional thieves. And then somebody comes and says what they know to be true, Hey, pipe down. And so
they live in a fantasy world.
Well, they don't. Well, they don't. They're perpetuating a fantasy about Chicago.
That's it.
And also, it's not just about money, and it's not just about unfunded pension liabilities and property taxes. It's about their participation in the maleducation of generation after generation of Chicago public school students, 95% of them at least. And the death on the streets of Chicago. I think it's about time, if we're just telling stories here and we're not going to make much difference, that at least the people who are willing to pipe up and risk offending a wealth manager in the city start to ascribe the responsibility to those people that they have for the death and the barbarism in the direction of children that they have helped to propagate. They like to think of themselves as good people. I'm on this charity board. I'm on this hospital board. I wrote a check to this or that or this candidate or that thing or that I attended that dinner. I, you know, bid on that auction item. And they're not. And just as we're talking about standing and delivering in the moment when it comes to COVID, how about standing and delivering in the moment with people you know have been entrenched as part of, as the business piece of the combine, and letting them know that you know that they bear some of the responsibility for the destruction of kids' futures in Chicago for the last 50 years and for the death that continues unabated every single day in this city. You are responsible, Morgan Stanley guy, Northern Trust guy, Goldman Sachs guy. You guys who lord over the city, Children's Hospital board member, BGA left-wing hack, you are responsible for what has happened to Chicago, what continues to happen. So when you pick up the paper or read something online about the latest kid who was murdered by the latest thug who's out on electronic monitoring, know that that's on you. You're not a good person. And you can continue deluding yourself, but I'm going to be participating in piping up to make sure that at least the people in my social circles don't suffer from the same delusion about you that you suffer from. Wouldn't that be interesting in terms of storytelling? Certainly would liven up some of those cocktail parties, wouldn't it?
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Because they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Is anyone really at this point considering preventing, to the extent you can, your children from going to university? Has anyone given up on the college system yet, such that they're telling their kids, I'll give you money to start a business. I'll provide you some support to get a place after you get a job. I'll make introductions for an apprenticeship program or an internship. And let's just go right from high school to some combination of work and a la carte learning, you know, all of the online offerings, Heterodox Academy. I tell you, we'll do the Heterodox Academy. We'll do the Western Canons, sort of independent study combined with getting right into pursuing a passion, apprenticing for somebody who's in a profession you want to pursue, getting a job in that sector, so on and so forth.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36, type in DA than a quick comment.
I ask because you hear from more and more professors from more and more prestigious universities, and I heard from one the other day that said, I wouldn't have said this 5 or 10 years ago, but I've given up on the university. He's not talking about his university specifically. He's including it. I've given up on the university system.
Well, it's so ghastly expensive. My God.
Well,
that's, I don't know how the heck that happened.
Well, because we subsidized it.
Right.
We told everybody has to get a college degree or you're a failure. So we subsidized it and then we made it a credential to be accepted in
society.
Sort of the status obsessed society, which is much of it. But they're saying it will not, it cannot confer what it promises to confer. Sending your kid to a university system would be like, you know, spinning a wheel to a university would be like spinning a wheel and picking a Chicago public school to send them to. Who's raising their hand to do that? And here's why. Good examples why. Yale Law School. Yale Law School. You know, it produces Supreme Court justices.
Right, and presidents.
Yeah.
Well, no, it was at Princeton or Harvard.
Captains of industry that go through Yale and get the law degrees.
And they love to talk about it at cocktail parties. I went to Harvard.
The Yale Federal Society recently had an event featuring two panelists that come from diametrically different places philosophically, but actually work together on a religious liberty case. Kristen Wagner of the Alliance for Defending Freedom and Monica Miller of the Progressive American Humanist Association. The purpose of the panel was to illustrate that a liberal atheist and a conservative Christian could find common ground on free speech issues, except there was no affording Ms. Wagner free speech because ADF, and you'll remember we talked to lawyers that represented Jack Phillips, among other cases, ADF represented Jack Phillips in the Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission case. You know, he can't be forced to make a cake he doesn't want to make. So you had some 100 students at Yale Law School shouted down. One protester telling one Federal Society member that she would, quote, literally fight you, bitch, unquote, according to audio obtained by the Washington Free Beacon. Protesters, once they were finally forced to exit the event, yelled, F you, Fed Society. Budding Yale law grads. Police officers had to arrive to escort both Wagner, ADF attorney, and Miller, the liberal atheist, out of the building. These two women, nobody knows, had to be escorted by police out of the building at Yale Law School. The response from the students to this whole imbroglio? More than 60 students of the law school's student body, Yale Law School, calling Michael Medved. 60% of the school's student body signed an open letter supporting the, what they called, peaceful student protesters who they claimed had been imperiled by the presence of police.
Oh, come on.
The danger of police, quoting the letter, yes. The danger of police violence in this country is intensified against black LGBTQ people and particularly black trans people. Police related trauma includes, but is certainly not limited to physical harm. Even with all the privilege afforded to us at Yale Law School, the decision to allow police officers in as a response to the protest put Yale Law School's queer student body at risk of harm. Signed by 417 students. The letter also condemned the professor presiding over the event. for telling those hysterical, shrieking Yale law students to grow up. Because, and I'm quoting the letter, that profoundly undermined our community's values of equity and inclusivity. So tell me again about how you hope your kid gets into Yale or goes to an Ivy League law school so he can get some job at a white shoe law firm in a big city. Is that really still the track that you want to put your kid on?
And what about, too, the parents who cater to their kids' every needs? I met somebody who's a firefighter whose daughter wants to be a marine biologist. So he's $245,000 in college debt. And guess where she's working? SeaWorld for $12 an hour feeding fish. Never going to be able to pay that student loan back. Mm-hmm. Ever. Unless he won the lotto or something. I mean, and that's not going to happen. And you can't even think about that.
My alma mater, Northwestern.
Yes.
You know what happens when I talk about Northwestern.
The value of your degree goes down.
That's correct.
Yes, it does. And it makes Iowa look better. Not really.
NUQ.
What's that? Oh, no.
The Northwestern University Qatari campus.
Oh.
A report authored by the Canary Mission, a watchdog group documenting anti-Semitism on U.S. college campuses. Qatar's multi-million dollar plan to influence American media. Report finds that administrators, professors, lecturers, graduates, and students at Northwestern Satellite Campus in Doha, Qatar's capital, were found to have made at least 750 anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, and anti-American social media postings. The Qatar Foundation and Al Jazeera Media Network put $50 million up, or they do annually, to fund the Northwestern University campus in Doha, Qatar, so that they can train, well, they can have administrators, professors, lecturers train students to promote anti-Semitism, anti-Israel positions, and anti-American positions. So, you know, the universities have long ago sold their souls. I mean, they're Marxists, so they're materialists. They long ago sold their souls for money. And now you're seeing this play out again and again and again. And now they've turned the schools over to the students. They're afraid of the students. They just want to protect their sinecures, the college presidents and the professorate. And so you want to send your kid to one of these places so they can learn to sell their soul on the cheap too? In addition to the debt that some incur, even if you had somebody pick up the tab, I'm not sure you can make a persuasive case that it makes sense to send your kid to an Ivy League school, to Northwestern. Maybe, I mean, there are some schools, obviously, we talk about them, Hillsdale College. But, you know, I mean, Hillsdale's just not big enough to accommodate, a few million college students. So if you're not going to Hillsdale or a small group of other institutions of actual higher learning, then what is the point? Think about the trade-off, not just in terms of what they have to endure and so on and so forth, but think about what kind of human being they're going to come out the other side as, even the most battle-tested. I mean, this is much worse, as of course we knew it would be, than when we were in college. You know,
I don't remember any of that.
Well,
indoctrination.
Well, what was happening? Sure. I mean, that was the height of political correctness. We had speech codes. Donna Shalala was the president of the University of Wisconsin at the time. She was promoting speech codes. We had all the nicknames being renamed because they were politically incorrect. That was, you know, that was second wave cultural Marxism. Now we're a fourth wave cultural Marxism. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636DA, turnkey.pro, text line, Diane in Dundee.
Hey, Diane.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. How are you?
Hey, hi. I had to switch you off with my speaker. And anyway, yeah, my daughter went to university right after the pandemic. So she was there over a year ago. And 3 weeks in, she called us up. And just when we got used to her being away, she said, you know, I want to come home and do school from home because we're in our room all the time. I said, okay. Totally worried, thinking, what's going on? Came home midweek. She said, you know, I think I don't want to go. She's like, I just don't want to go to university anymore. She was in University of Iowa, by the way.
Okay.
On a scholarship and honors program, the whole thing. I think there was a lot of just different things going on there already, even with the small group she was in. I know some of the writing assignments she had in her honors program, they were geared towards, and I don't remember the paper she wrote, but it was like it was a poem, and they were studying an example of a poem was someone who was a literary author, but it was a completely, it was a poem completely skewed towards like a racist.
Yeah, all the identity stuff,
yeah.
Right? Which
completely,
right? Of
completely.
Course.
So
anyway, so where is she now?
She went to her second choice for her life was to go to beauty school. She's cutting hair. We bought her a car because that was her college money. Totally happy. Moving out in a couple of weeks with a friend and just living her life. And she's realized that now in her career choice, she can make a decent living.
Yeah.
Good.
She could be the next Mario Tricosi. Who knows?
She's got six figures in debt.
And, you know, it is so funny because she said to me, she's like, you know, she goes, I have this money because we've been saving for her college. And she said, I have this money that's left over. She's like, she started a Roth IRA that'll get withdrawn. She's like, okay, so I have my retirement savings. She said, you know, in about 5 years, I'm just going to save whatever money I can and then just buy a house or whatever. She's like, all my friends will be done with school. She said, by the time I would be done with what she wanted to do, she needed a master's. So she said, I'd be in school for at least 10 years, probably needing a doctorate. Mm-hmm. She was going into a science field. And she said, I don't want to be 30 and $200,000 in debt.
Yep, that's what's
thanks for the call,
a
Diane.
Lot of people right now.
But I mean, also too, I mean, if people want, address like the character formation piece of this. Do you want all, I mean, talk about the K-12 level, people getting, you want all the work that you do at home, raising your kids, to be undone at school and then at college? You want them to go from college to some ghastly, sterile, soulless corporate environment? So that whatever the K-12 and collegiate system wasn't able to accomplish, corporate America can finish them off? Taylor on the north side.
Hey, Dan and Amy, love your show. Dan, what you said about the trade-offs is so interesting because I got a public relations degree at Illinois State, and my brother got an advertising and media studies degree from University of Illinois. So after I graduated, I got into the trades and I like worked for my dad. And then my brother, he works for Disney, and we are two completely different people. I mean, he lives in Lakeview. I live at home in the suburbs, and I'm 26. He's in his 30s now. And it's just so interesting. Like you said, it's this woke culture that they just groom these people and their employees. It doesn't end at college. It's that to me, that's just the beginning. You come home from your break, your winter break, spring breaks, and you can see it with your own eyes. Like, who is this person? This isn't the kid that I raised. And that has completely happened to so many kids and so many families. So I definitely recommend if you're a parent, try not to motivate your kids and pursue your kids to go the college route because it's brutal there. So You guys have a great day.
Thanks for the call, Taylor. Thanks, I mean, Taylor. You know, there's going to be exceptions. There are going to be people want to become a professor or something. It's fine. Lawyer. Right. I mean, you want
doctor.
You want sensible people in all these professions too. But so what we're talking about is the scale. And, you know, I mean, really borrowing from Mike Rowe, just ending this idea that a BA is a threshold you have to clear to get gigs at so many places to start a business. And ending these universities, forget the alumni donations. Don't send your kids. Don't send them. Unless they're, you know, in very rarefied tracks.
But there is a social aspect to college, though, too.
There's a social aspect to life. What do you mean? You're 18 years old. You don't have a social life? You can't have a social life if you're not on a college campus? And by the way, I mean, what is the social life on college campuses like?
Right now, bad. A lot of drinking. Oh, Mike Scott's doing the...
Well,
yeah, but that's
every... But, I mean, you think like... You know, I'm not. I can't be a fully formed person unless I go through Greek life on a college campus. Are you kidding? You know, the rites of passage can change as the culture changes. You know, what used to be sort of humorous and actually bond building, consistent with sort of American cultural values. That's just not no longer the case. You have to recognize the changes when they occur. Now, I know that there are outposts and there are cells within these colleges where it's still like that. I get it. This, you know, these are general statements. But the general statement is the general disposition towards college needs to do a 180. Tom Oswego.
I've got three older children. My daughter, when she graduated school here locally in a Christian school, went to Western. After about 9 months, she called me and said, "Dad, I can't be here anymore." Now, fortunately, they grew up in a conservative family with, you know, faith values. So she dropped out, went to a pastry school in Chicago, did very well for herself. My oldest son, he went to law school, and I'll say it was at Northern. His first year, he told me, "Dad, I can't believe how liberal it is. That's all they talk about." I said, "Well, it shouldn't be that liberal. You're talking about laws.
Yeah,
that's black or a lot of that's black or white." He goes, "No, Dad,
yeah,
you'd
right.
be surprised." He struggled. Now, he didn't live on campus. We live 40 minutes from campus, so he at least got to stay home and have dinner with us. And we talked about things, so he wasn't indoctrinated. My youngest son went, and I'll say it, went to North Central here. He's finishing up his master's. The first year he went to school there, some of their projects was they had to get up and introduce themselves. You know, used to do in high school, "Hi, my name's Tom. I go to school." Well, they had to get up and say what they wanted to be called, how they wanted to be called.
Yeah, pronouns. "Hi, my name's Tom." Right, of course.
Really?
He
literally flipped his lid. And I couldn't believe how liberal some of these, quote unquote, conservative institutions are. I would encourage people, I personally think that a lot of people or parents, and I know this is generalizing, that send their kids to school, they use their kids as trophies for themselves. "Oh, my son is going to so-and-so."
Yeah. I know a lot of people like that.
School.
For sure.
And it's a shame because these kids, and I've seen them when they get out of college, it's amazing how much they don't know. Yeah. I'm in the trades. I own my own business. It's almost scary. And I talked to my youngest son last night about this. And I said, "I worry more about your generation because of what they don't know."
Yeah.
They don't care to know.
Thanks, Tom. We got to go, but I appreciate the call. I mean, here, the other thing, too, is in the digital world in which we live, everything that you want to know that you're interested to learn is at your fingertips.
Right.
If you do the work. So you need all of this sort of a phony baloney Potemkin village environment to learn what you want to learn? No, you don't. No, you don't. Yeah, I mean, I know it's difficult because there's just so much inertia and so much pressure. But I mean, think about, you know, you were talking about the parents that use kids as trophies. Think about the people you know that are always – prattling on, you know, decades after they graduated, but where they went to college, they got those empty, pathetic people. You know, by the way, I went to Northwestern.
Go Hawks.
Let me be a cautionary tale. Yeah, to you. You know, like that's a big credential. Like that's a big accomplishment.
Well, what did you do with your diploma? Is it hanging on the walls? Is it framed somewhere so people can see it when they walk in your place?
No, the only diploma I have on my wall is my kindergarten diploma.
Oh, that's right.
That set me on the right path. Got it figured out early, and then the rest was smooth sailing.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, which would you like to hear? Joe Biden explaining revenge porn or Elizabeth Warren explaining inflation and death is not an option?
The first one.
Joe Biden explaining revenge porn?
Yeah. I would like to hear that, please. I must have missed that yesterday.
Sure.
So we established a new civil rights cause of action for those whose intimate images were shared on the public screen. How many times have you heard? I bet everybody knows somebody somewhere along the line that in an intimate relationship, what happened was the guy takes a revealing picture of his naked friend or whatever in a compromising position.
What? I thought you were joking.
And then, literally, in a sense, blackmails or mortifies that person. Send it out. Put it online.
But enough about Hunter Biden, really. If we could get back to talking about inflation.
Yeah, he was talking about his son.
He's so current with the pitfalls of modern life in the digital age, is President Biden. A really helpful explanation of revenge porn. So he's got his eye on the prize and the big issues that a president has to deal with. Elizabeth Warren.
Yes, not to serious matters.
Marginally more serious. This is Elizabeth Warren, remember, who has proposed now a windfall tax on oil companies. In this period of gas prices at historic levels. This is her explanation of why we have arguably double-digit inflation at present.
So I think the primary cause of this bout of price increases starts with COVID and the fact that we have supply chain kinks and that people rapidly shifted the demand curve so that demand for services went down and demand for goods went up. So those two have forced prices up. That's part one. But what has also happened is that now that we live in an America where there's a lot more concentration in certain industries, look at the oil industry, look at meat industry, look at groceries generally, that what's happened is these companies have said, you know, we'll pass along costs, but while we're at it and everyone's talking about rising costs, let's just add an extra big dollop of cost increases to expand our profits.
Profiteering companies, that's the deal with inflation at present. So interesting, she didn't mention Putin. I thought it was Putin's price hike, but it's COVID. It's the virus did it. And then the supply chains broke themselves.
Right.
And now it's profiteering by evil corporations.
Right.
For more on this, I don't know which he'll prefer to talk about. We can talk about revenge porn if he wants, or we can talk about inflation in Ukraine. Either way, Gerard Baker, editor-at-large, Wall Street Journal. Gerard, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
I'll take inflation for 50, please.
Okay, sure. All right. Well, inflation.
I had a feeling you would say that.
Then the answer is Elizabeth Warren's explanation of inflation.
What makes no sense, unless you're a Harvard professor, maybe is the answer to that.
Correct.
This idea that we're suddenly experiencing corporate greed, which is the reason why inflation has gone from, remember, inflation has gone from 1%, just over 1% in November 2020, right at the end of the Trump administration, to 7.9%. And as you said, Dan, actually double digits in terms of producer price inflation. which is, you know, sort of further along, further back rather in the supply chain. The idea that, that suddenly that this, this spurt in inflation is due in any significant part whatsoever to companies suddenly deciding that they can push along price increases and more to their consumers just defies all kind of economic logic and history. First of all, you know, corporate profits are have been reasonably healthy for quite some time. There's been no sudden sort of spike in corporate profits as a result of price increases in the last year. And secondly, you know, we do this is just a smokescreen, right, Dan? It's this attempt to divert any attention or responsibility from this administration for what's been going on. Now, look, I stress, and I said in my column this week, it's true, Biden is not responsible for inflation. Inflation is a global phenomenon. Inflation did pick up again at the end of 2020 as the economy came back from the pandemic and there were these supply chain disruptions. But what they did, and this is really important, and I do, and I don't, you know, I said in my column this week, I mean, how stupid do they have, do they think the American people have to be to believe that it's, but it's one of these explanations that it's, you know, corporate profiteering or it's Putin's price hike, when people are very well aware for the last year, every single month they've been going to the grocery store, they've been going to the gas station, they've been seeing these price rises going along, and they know that a large part of it, they do understand that a large part of it is the responsibility of government, and the particular responsibility of this government, this administration, is that they added a huge amount of money to a huge amount of demand to the economy with that very unnecessary $2 trillion at the beginning of last year, which poured fuel onto the fire of inflation. So they're not, yes, they don't have total responsibility for this, should be clear about that, but they really significantly, at a time when they should have been cautious, they should have been careful about about increasing demand in that way, and when supply chains were so tight, that's the problem. When supply chains are so tight and you add that amount of demand, the only thing that can happen is the prices can rise. And that is what they did, and they do bear that responsibility. And all this diversionary stuff about Putin and corporate profiteering is just a smokescreen, and people see through it.
But it's so weird because CBS did a poll and a study where they asked Americans, you know, are you okay with the rising gas prices as a way to get back at Putin? And 70% said yes. You know, we'll take the hit at the pump to do our part to help Ukraine. I mean, how dumb are Americans collectively?
Oh, are they dumb or are they just giving the pollster the answer that they want, that they're supposed to give to be right, virtuous, right?
Right, exactly. The question could be reframed. Are you a selfish, heartless person?
Exactly. Who cares
only about okay, minimizing the amount you have to pay at the pump every week? Or do you care about poor people who are being bombed to smithereens by a cruel, evil dictator? I mean, it's, you know, yeah, I agree. Amy, that's the message of that.
Well, and you see,
it's unbelievable.
And you see it. Yeah, well, you see, I mean, but that's the pressure that's put on by our, you know, empty-headed virtue signaling cancel culture. But you see that with the surveying on, you know, do you support a no-fly zone? As you know, everybody has moved from being an epidemiologist to now a geopolitical military strategist. But do you support a no-fly zone? Yes. Why? You know, I don't know. Zelensky said he needs one. Do you support a no-fly zone if you understood it that's escalation and it means we'd go to war with Russia, and then it flips, you know, it flips on it to opposition. So it's the whole point of explaining implications, because we as a culture, starting with the elites, don't seem to do a very good job of connecting dots.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think people do understand, you know, I think, again, politicians and elites, particularly, and Elizabeth Warren, you know, that clip you played, you know, in that very sort of didactic, again, Harvard professor kind of, I'm going to explain to you stupid rubes out there what is actually going on.
Right.
I think people actually do get it on some level. Okay, they don't have PhDs in economics, and they don't necessarily completely, you know, fully experience or understanding of how, you know, global supply chains work, but they basically get it because they see things. They're aware of things. And by the way, they are dealing with things in a way that some of these elites just aren't. They are dealing with they've been dealing with the reality of rising prices for, you know, again, for more than a year now. They've seen what they see what's happening. They see, and by the way, they also turn to their government and they say, you know, you need to do something about this. We've seen this in the past. We've had inflation, terrible spikes of inflation in the past, 1970s most obviously. And you know, most people are not as old as me, and they don't have memories that long, but they do know that they're aware that inflation, you know, is a real problem. Once it takes hold, it's incredibly hard to get down again. The Federal Reserve, by the way, which of course has primary responsibility for this, finally raised interest rates yesterday. They do understand how it affects their lives, and they do understand how serious it is. And they're being patronized by these elites who are telling them, trying to tell them all these kinds of things that aren't true.
Well, yeah, not to mention, I mean, patronized and then just downright downright insulted between the eyes. You don't like the gas prices? Well, go buy a Tesla.
Yeah, there's that too. Yeah, that is let them eat. Yeah, that's the ultimate let them eat cake, isn't it? For 2022 going to Stephen Colbert. You know, I don't have to worry about my gas prices because I've got a Tesla. I mean, and these people, by the way, the same Stephen Colbert who's been telling us, you know, what we should think about, you know, Trump and Russia and the Democrats and Joe Biden and the state of democracy and all this kind of stuff for so long, and they just with a comment like that, they just reveal how completely out of touch they are with actually not only what's going on, but with ordinary people's lives.
So, Mr. Baker, should we get used to these high gas prices? Is this just going to be the new normal and the high grocery and everything else, gas bills?
No, I don't know that. I mean, yes. I mean, unfortunately, so yes and no. Sorry, there's a classic sort of economist answer. I'm not an economist, but I did stay in a holiday inn last night. But I mean, I don't think we're necessarily going to see these gas prices that we've seen in the last couple of weeks or something. In fact, as you know, the oil prices have actually come down in the last few days. I think there was a bit of a, you know, I mean, inevitably when you get a shock to the system like you had with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the markets immediately kind of go to the most extreme because there's so much uncertainty. They fear the worst, so they push prices. You know, prices tend to go to a very high level. They have come back a little bit, I think, as people have figured out, look, there are ways in which this oil supply will actually, you know, might not be quite as constrained. In fact, world oil supplies have been increasing in the last few years, despite what the U.S. is doing, of course, which the U.S. administration, the Biden administration, is trying to restrict U.S. oil supply. But in the rest of the world, there is more oil. There is a sense that, you know, well, if we don't buy Russian oil, Russia's going to sell its oil to China. China will stop buying oil from parts of the world where it's been buying oil, and we'll be able to buy that. There's a kind of circular notion to that. So these oil prices are coming down a little bit. Now they might go back up. You know, it's very volatile. If there's things really take off, an even worse turn in Ukraine, that could happen. But oil prices are a bit lower than they were. The problem is that the inflation that is now embedded in the system, I think, is going to go on for a while because, you know, it's what people talk about, a wage price spiral. And, you know, we now see consumer price inflation at nearly 8%. We have wages rising at only 5-6%. So Americans are taking a hit. This is where it's so painful. But even as their wages are rising strongly, prices are rising faster. So they're going to push for higher wages, understandably. And then that's going to push up costs, and companies are going to want to push it. That's what we saw classically in the 1970s when, you know, one-point inflation got as high as, what, 15, 16, 17%, as wages were pushing companies and they wanted to maintain their profits or at least not have them squeeze so much. That's the danger we're in, and that's usually, unfortunately, and this is the really bad news, that is usually, unfortunately, only broken by a really nasty recession, a really bad recession, when the Federal Reserve raises interest rates so high that it literally just crunches the economy and nobody can, you know, the investment stops, people can't afford to buy houses, the economy comes to a sort of a crunching halt. And we may be, unfortunately, in that kind of situation again. That's the only way to get on top of this inflation is to bring the economy down.
He is Gerard Baker, editor-at-large, Wall Street Journal. Gerard, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer. This is Chicago's morning answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Since we started talking about it with Gerard Baker last hour, let's localize it a bit. Let's talk a little bit about the price at the pump, because our old friend Willie Wilson, former mayoral candidate and presidential candidate, you remember.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
And I think he might be announcing something soon, too. But what's he doing today is amazing.
$200,000 worth of free gas he's giving away starting now. So get in line at where the he's got the list of gas stations where he's buying people gas.
Yeah, the list is Washington Park, Amstar, that's on Garfield Boulevard. We've got one in Calumet Heights, the Citgo there at Stony Island Avenue, South Deering in the Marathon Station there on East 59th Street. And that place, if you're watching Channel 9 or any other station, you could see it. The gas lines are 2 to 5 miles long. For people and police, Chicago police are by each intersection to make sure people can cross over 95th Street. It's the great gas giveaway. There's also one at Irving Park in Pulaski. I've heard that one. There's a huge line, miles long, and Chicago police are out there too, just making sure that people stay in line, they don't cut, and they let the intersection remain open.
If anybody's in line for Willie Wilson's Great Gas Giveaway, give us a call, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. And while you're in line, you may ask the question that I'm thinking, which is, hey, all you Democrat Biden voters waiting in line for Willie Wilson's
Great Gas Giveaway,
why are you driving a fossil fuel car? Why haven't you taken the advice of the Jennifer Granholms and the Mayor Pete's of the world and picked up yourself a Tesla yet?
Oh, yeah, they're real cheap. Are there any used Teslas for sale?
I'm sure there are.
Possibly. So just so you know, real quick, though, you can only receive up $50 of free gas. Then you have to move along and they're handing out.
That's not even a full tank.
No, it's not. And then you have to they're handing out free notepads on behalf of Willie Wilson.
Uh-huh.
So maybe you can doodle. Write down some things while you're waiting in that long line and burning gas while you're waiting to get gas.
I love Willie Wilson's cash giveaways. Now, I'm partial because if you remember when Willie Wilson ran for mayor, I was the founder of Whitey's for Willie.
That's right.
I was a club president.
That's right.
And I did.
Did you ever have a T-shirt that said Whitey's for Willie?
No, I didn't. I
but you did
made
vote
one.
For him, didn't you? Didn't
I voted for Willie Wilson in 2019. Absolutely. Absolutely did.
I voted for Paul Vallis.
And, you know, I remember the conversations we had, too. Like, oh, you know, Willie Wilson, you know, because of his sort of unique communication style. Willie Wilson, you know, he's not polished enough to be mayor. He doesn't, you know, speak like the great orators who've been mayors of Chicago, like, you know, Richie Daley.
Geez, Dems and Dose.
So you think Willie Wilson could have done any worse than Lori Lightfoot? You think anybody, you know, spin the wheel and pick a name out of a telephone book and anybody could have done worse than Lori Lightfoot? But I digress. The oil matter, too, since we were talking about that, Elizabeth Warren and her, you know, oil and gas companies are padding their profit margins. That's the same thing that the big guy is saying. And in point of fact, that's not happening. Gerard Baker mentioned that that is a lie, but here's some of the details. According to the most recent data from the Energy Information Administration, 56% of the cost of gasoline is the hard cost of crude oil that the refiners have to pay. A chart that was posted on Bloomberg yesterday, shows that the price increase at the pump failed to keep up with the incredible jump in crude oil prices. It also shows that oil companies were making less money, not more, on the way up. That's why it seems to some that prices go up much faster than they fall, because after a big price spike in crude, most oil companies get squeezed on the revenue side on the way up. It's very clear that energy companies did not pass on the entire price increase in the cost of crude oil and may have to keep prices higher longer to make back the revenue they lost on the way up. That's what's actually happening, as opposed to Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren and their ilk are telling you. And by the way, here in Illinois, we need to get stickers with Biden and Pritzker that say, I did that, with the fingers pointing to the price at the pump.
Because he taxed our tax, right?
Because Pritzker doubled the state gas tax.
Doubled. That's why people are driving to Wisconsin, where it is 72 cents cheaper a gallon, because that is what we're paying in our gas tax.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, it's 62 cents.
Yeah, I mean, it's.
But still, that is a lot of money.
Chicago always is right near the top, right just behind California, in terms of highest gas prices, because of the tax on gas
I didn't know you could tax the tax, but I guess you can tax.
You absolutely can.
And then you have the state tax, county tax.
You absolutely can.
Yeah, city tax. It's a lot of taxes.
And Willie Wilson, I wonder if Willie Wilson will get, you know, he's done the cash giveaways before and some people, he's buying votes and so on and so forth. Who isn't? What politician isn't buying votes?
But he's honest about it.
Maybe he'll get renewed consideration because, I don't know, I don't hear any other compelling names putting themselves forward, do you? And by the way, we're in cycle for the mayor's race.
Right. It's on. I mean, what is Mayor Lightfoot doing today? She's in Miami having a fundraiser for her campaign.
It's basically a year away. And, you know, they do this on purpose. It's incumbency protection. But it runs concurrent with the cycle. I mean, you go from the November election and you've got a February primary for for mayor come February of 2023. And then, of course, the runoff, if there is one, that goes to April. So the time is now to make a decision if you're going to go or not go. And by the way, we'll talk to Alderman Ray Lopez at the bottom of the hour, 15th Ward Alderman. He's one of the names that's being bandied about for mayor, too. But this is the time. And Willie Wilson is taking advantage of it. And I got to tell you, on this idea of, you know, I did that stickers, Biden and Pritzker in this state with the doubling of the state gas tax. Willie Wilson's taking advantage of it. How about Republicans? Where are the Republican gubernatorial candidates pointing this out? How obvious is this? Rank incompetence. You have people across the country with the Biden did that stickers. You got Pritzker who doubled the state gas tax.
Doubled it.
And who else is talking about that other than this show? What Republican candidate for governor or Republican candidates, generally speaking, Republican leadership? How obvious is this? Is this not a big deal? Do they not get it? Do they? Maybe the lines they see at all the gas stations where Willie Wilson is giving away $50 in gas today, maybe it'll wake some people up. I mean, they're just so bad at what they do, aren't they?
That's a great point. They should have a campaign commercial about it right now or sell the stickers.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, I was just talking about Willie Wilson's gas giveaway and the price at the pump.
Yeah.
The Chiron on CNN, we monitor so you don't have to. Jennifer Granholm is on there talking to one of the mopes that, you know, reads the teleprompter.
The former mayor of Michigan?
She may or may not be the former governor of Michigan. Joe Biden doesn't know.
Right.
So he's going to get back to us on that. Jennifer Granholm, yesterday on The Moment at a clean energy confab, this moment that Ukraine provides.
This crisis in Europe and the crisis our allies are facing and the reduction of supply of natural gas and oil from Russia creates a moment that we should be acting. I mean, we heard President Zelensky. We do not want to see any country that is held hostage to Vladimir Putin. And this is a moment for Congress to be able to act. There can be a compromise. There can be movement on this. And whether it's, you know, I mean, what the form is and who sponsors are and all of that, that's a conversation that's happening. But the bottom line is this is a moment to have this happen. It's an urgent moment.
She's talking about the Green New Deal. Right. She's trying to resuscitate the Green New Deal. Of course they are in this moment, the Green New Deal.
They care about climate change at this point in our world.
The Chiron on CNN.
Oh, yes.
Biden demands faster drop in gas prices. You shall drop.
Right now, Biden demands faster drop in gas prices as oil prices start to tumble.
I mean, do you understand? This is how they actually think. I command you to drop. And of course, we're going to scapegoat the oil companies because you have to have a scapegoat. They're making record profits. They're padding their profit margin, as you heard Elizabeth Warren say. And just to repeat, gas prices almost always rise faster than they fall. A Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis report concluded in 2014 because somebody over there at that Federal Reserve Bank understands economics. I mean, this is not news. But I know how the Biden administration likes to cite Nobel Prize winning economists and arcane reports, a few one-off politicized economists who support this crackpottery that they offer, like they're offering right now, trying to scapegoat the oil companies. When oil prices rise after being steady for some time, gasoline prices shoot up quickly, according to the Fed Reserve study out of St. Louis. In contrast, when oil prices fall after being steady for some time, gasoline prices retreat slowly. Individual retailers set gas prices based on what they expect their future fuel deliveries to cost. But they have no clue right now due to all the global uncertainty. Oil prices have plunged this week in part because the United Arab Emirates said it would urge OPEC to pump more, but the cartel might not. Markets also forecast that China's lockdowns, if they continue, will dampen global growth and fuel demand this year, but they may not. These are the uncertainties that the Wall Street Journal opined about in referencing this 2014 report by the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. And so, I mean, this is actually the intelligent discussion that is about the marketplace, if you understand why things are happening or not happening, rather than just the cheap, economically illiterate politics of the left.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and we were talking about Willie Wilson's great gas giveaway, $200,000 worth of free gas at a handful of stations around the metropolitan area. Not only is he paying for the gas,
he's pumping it, man.
He's out there pumping it. He joins us now. Willie, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. Hey, what's up?
Good, good. How y'all doing?
Good. So, Willie, what gave you the idea to give away gas?
Well, the basic bottom line was that people was asking me to help them get to work and things of that nature. And then I pulled in the service station. It was higher than me. And so people just needed it. People couldn't get to work because of their disposable income. And it was a need to help. I gave it to $200,000. And to see all these people out here now today around these 10 service stations, I should have gave more, you know?
Well, why didn't you just give everybody a Chevy Volt?
Well, maybe I should have.
Yeah, there you go. And the charging station. Throw in the charging station, too. You're going to need that.
Yeah. Well, I think that what happened is that it's such a need into the community. Well, we didn't just do it in one area. We put 10 stations so we could probably cover all of Chicago as much as we could. And so the only thing I kind of like now look at is that we probably should have did more, gave a little bit more money than what we gave, you know, to help more people out.
Well, you can always do more. So what are people saying who are coming up and seeing you pump and pay for their gas?
Well, they just say, you know, thank you, and taking some pictures and things. But that's there's a need, and it's sad to see the need into the community that people can't get to work hard because they ain't got gas, the money to pay for it.
It's heartbreaking. And these lines are miles long. I mean, at the 95th Street station, police are saying it's 7 miles long, people waiting to get free gas.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I should have gave more money.
Yeah.
Are you almost tapped out?
Are you telling them to vote Republican if they don't like these gas prices?
Well, listen, I don't like the gas prices, you know? I think that by doing this, I think that a lot of people have a lot more resources than I have. I think we all should get together and try to pitch in together and try to help the citizens of Chicago here to make a living in terms of gas and buy food for their family and things of that nature. I just think that I think it's sad. You know, United States and people don't have the income. I think we all should do more and do better. A lot of people got a lot more money than I got, you know?
Yeah. No, I hear you. And so is this part of like a run-up to another mayoral run by any chance?
Well, if you look at my record, I've been doing this here for 15, 30, 20 years. I've never stopped giving. We pay taxes and we feed the hungry, you know, people up the street. We do all of that. No, I don't play with people out of hood like this. I would never do that. Last year, we gave away $4 million out here to people that didn't have food or had to pay taxes, non-violent, out of jail and all this kind of stuff. Having a senior citizen that live out $3 a week for food. I just thought about this last week when people kept telling me that they didn't have money to get to work. Mm-hmm. And then I look up at this sign, and I just started to do it. There's no motivation behind this no more than to help some people, you know?
And how do you think Lori Lightfoot is doing in terms of serving the interests of the people who are struggling to put gas in their tank to get to work?
Well, I mean, look, her record speaks for itself, Dan. Like everybody knows this city is not a lot more, I think, it should be doing in the state, too. But I don't know. I think well, people got to judge her for themselves. My job is to try to help people to get food on their table and help make their lives better for them. And I don't think focus on that because,
all right,
you know, to keep talking about things and we got to do something. So that's what I'm doing. I don't know. I don't know. But everybody knows the mayor, what record that she have and what she's doing. I'll let everybody else judge her, you know? Okay. Not me.
All right. Well, I think people are judging you positively for this $200,000 gas giveaway that you're doing. It's a very nice thing. So good for you, Willie. And thanks, as always, for joining us. We appreciate it.
All right. Well, I want you guys, you and Amy, to come out and help me next time I do this because we're going to have to do this again, all right?
Will I get a free fill-up if I come out?
You get more than a free fill-up. You get the motorcycle, too, you know?
All right. Very good.
I'll wash people's windshields. Yes.
All right. Thanks, Willie.
All right. Thank you, guys.
All right. And now let's switch gears and introduce our next guest. But sort of
someone
same,
who might be running for mayor.
Same topic areas, yes. Really. We'll also include police in our conversation with Alderman Ray Lopez, who's the alderman for the 15th Ward in the city. Alderman Lopez, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Dan and Amy, good morning.
Are you,
God bless Dr. Wilson.
Yeah, are you waiting in line to get Philip, or where are you?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm finishing feeding my dogs this morning. Well, giving me that look that they love to give me.
Oh, yes.
Maybe that'll be the next thing Willie does, free dog food. He'll come over and feed your dog and fill up your tank at some point. We'll see. So let's start with the Chicago Police. And
yesterday.
And tell us what you think about the Lightfoot slow roll on this vax mandate issue.
Well, I'm very disappointed in our mayor and, quite frankly, in a majority of my colleagues for failing to come to work yesterday to answer and resolve some of the issues that a number of our city employees, including our police officers, have with regards to the mandate. You know, we've seen as the city, as the county, as the state, and as the country inches back towards normalcy, Lightfoot is, you know, white-knuckling her control on the city, refusing to budge, refusing to evolve her policies to reflect the ever-evolving science surrounding COVID, to be more accommodating and understanding to the world as we know it. And I believe that she's intentionally and arbitrarily drawing this line in the sand to try to feel as though she's still in control of things, even though we've seen in other instances, such as at CPS and with CTU, she clearly was not.
Oh yeah.
The only thing that this harms is our citizens because we are already razor thin on losing our ability to keep people safe, as we talk about routinely. And if she thinks that this won't impact our ability to keep Chicagoans safe, she's clearly delusional.
Yeah, I mean, this is about control and power, not health and safety, because you know the positivity rate, it's all already fallen again to 0.6%. But so she didn't attend your special city council meeting, but neither did others. Only 17 aldermen showed up, and you needed 26 in order to hold a meeting about natural immunity. So what's your next step?
You know, thankfully, the resolution that we were assembling yesterday to speak about was already submitted. I'm hopeful, and we will continue to reach out to Alderman Roger Sawyer, chairman of the Health Committee, to see if he will put it on the docket so that it can be discussed before next week's regular city council meeting. But let's be honest. This mayor clearly picks and chooses which part of the scientific data she wants to use in order to weaponize it against her employees and her foes, particularly the Chicago Police Department. She's not interested in hearing any opinion other than her own, and we have to continue to stand up and push back. You know, I am thankful that 2 years ago, it was just two or three of us pushing back, and now we're almost at 20 people pushing back routinely. So I think that we will continue to fight, but we cannot give an inch to this mayor who is just hell-bent on doing her own thing, consequences be damned.
I thought this was interesting. I saw a post from the Chicago Police Department now waiving the 60 college credit hour requirement for candidates with experience in various areas, social services, healthcare, education, the trades. But waiving the 60-hour college credit requirement all of a sudden, why would that be?
The reason is very simple. We can't get anyone interested who's qualified to want to be a police officer at this point. And they're going to continue to lower their standards just to try and make their quotas into the academy. And that's going to have a very negative impact on our police department and on the quality of officers that we're trying to create in the city of Chicago. What we are facing is hundreds of officers leaving the police department year over year. My understanding is that we have already lost half, 50% of the officers that we lost all of 2021 have already left in terms of numbers in 2022. Over 400 officers have resigned this year alone. Already, or left the department. We simply cannot keep up with these numbers of attrition at the rate that we're going with the standards that we have. Next thing I'm assuming that they're going to waive is probably residency, just to recruit anybody to come into the city and be a police officer.
Well, other, you know, suburban police departments like Elk Grove here, they're giving signing bonuses of $10,000. So they need some police officers. They're like, hey, Chicago, you know, we don't have any vaccine mandates. We'll take you. Have you ever thought maybe it's going to come to that where we have to give signing bonuses? And do you think that they'll do that?
I think you could waive every requirement. You could waive every residency rule. You can waive signing bonuses in front of people. Nobody wants to work for the city of Chicago's police department in an environment where they are constantly viewed as the enemy, where they are treated as less than everyone else simply for doing the job that we have trained and asked them to do. It is more an issue of how they are treated than of what we're offering. And I don't think until that changes, we'll be able to stem the tide when it comes to recruitment and retention within our department.
John Catanzaro was on our program the other day, and he suggested that he expects this year to be even bloodier than last year, which was even bloodier than 2020. And all of those years were very bloody. What are the residents in the neighborhoods you represent saying about the violence? I mean, we've already had more than 100 murders and more than 500 people shot here in mid-March. What are you anticipating for the summer, and what are your residents saying to you about their safety?
Sadly, I don't have to wait for the summer, Dan, to see how bad it's going to be. Just yesterday, we had 10 rounds fired off less than 20 feet from one of my schools in West Englewood, 10 minutes before parents were coming for a social event with their children in the building. That's March 16th. Mm-hmm. We are already seeing the violence escalate weeks on end in many neighborhoods, and the police department and our local police districts, though they try their best, are unable to get a hold of things because of the poor staffing policies and other things coming out of headquarters from people who have never served on the street and think that this is all some great academic exercise in police and city urban policing. Their policies are failing, and I do think that we're going to continue to see an escalation in the amount of bloodshed on our streets this year, probably worse than ever any year before. And as we see the combination of poor leadership, inability to execute and maintain law and order, and of course, the double whammy coming out of the state's attorney's office, where you will have mutual combatants and unintended targets being given free pass for the crime and mayhem that's going on in our streets.
That's so ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, we've been doing it all week in conjunction with CWB Chicago, their Electronic Monitoring Appreciation Week, sarcastically, of course. And 70 people now last year that killed or attempted to kill somebody while they were awaiting trial on felony charges, often class X, you know, violent felonies. And the program continues unencumbered. It's unimpeded. There's no recognition that something has to change with turning violent criminals, habitual violent criminals, back out in the streets, even for a short time before they're tried.
And look, even Chief Judge Timothy Evans said that what you just said doesn't happen. He said,
right,
there's no evidence that people on electronic monitoring do anything bad.
Right.
I mean,
he
needs to go. I mean, the 16-year-old kid that shot the 8-year-old girl who was, you know, on a sunny Saturday afternoon walking down the street. You know, he didn't even want that 16-year-old. Yeah, he didn't even want that 16-year-old to go to jail. He thought therapy would be better. And he said that publicly.
Well, right. You don't have the mens rea to commit a crime until you're 25, we understand from Chief Judge Evans.
And, you know, there are plenty of things that are in a lot of these reform bills and all these other measures that are being put in place. You know, we've got Kim Fox with her mutual combatants. We've got this new rule that says if you shoot someone and they're the unintended target and you kill them, you won't be charged with murder now because that's not who you were aiming for. You know, there's all kinds of madness going on in Illinois when it comes to criminal justice. But the one thing that's missing is where's the compassion for the victims and for those innocent people in the communities who are just trying to pursue the American dream and can't because they're being terrorized repeatedly and oftentimes by the same people. You know, we can have compassion and we can make things easier for people who commit, you know, a once in a lifetime event, who maybe just make a bad choice once in their life, but we know that they'll never do it again. But we cannot give compassion to those people who have rap sheets 5 pages long, who are dedicated to violence, who are dedicated to gang life, who are dedicated to criminality. We have to drop the hammer on these people because there's no program, there's no compassion, there's no restorative justice that's ever going to change their minds to be anything less than what they are, which are terrorists in our neighborhoods.
And put the same question to you we put to Willie. You know, we're a year from a mayoral election, so sneaks up on you pretty quickly. Your name has been bandied about as a possible candidate. What are you thinking?
Well, I don't think there's an alderman out there that's never thought about being mayor. It's kind of like cardinals in the church. You know, everyone knows you could become mayor. Or
Pope in that case. Pope. Yeah, right.
You know, I'm looking at it. You know, my dream job was always to be an alderman and to serve my residents. But clearly, we are seeing how a bad mayor can make that an impossibility. So we'll continue to explore all options, but I think that right now my focus has to be on protecting our workers so that they can protect our neighborhoods.
All right. He is Ray Lopez. He's the alderman for the 15th Ward. Alderman Lopez, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, how has everybody liked the end of the mask mandate and the vax passes in Chicago? It's only been a week.
No one's doing it. At school, my kids say out of all of their teachers, only one teacher is unmasked.
Well, you know what? That's perfect because it's time to lock her down again.
Huh?
Shut it down.
Well, that's what they were saying at the press conference. Like, how can you unmask people? Because in China, they're all locked down, and it's coming. Another variant's going to be here. We're all going to die.
China is facing major outbreaks in Shanghai and Shenzhen. Uh-huh. Also this, and I'm reading from noted COVIDian Eric Topol, who is the founder and director of Scripps Research Translational Institute. He's a professor of molecular medicine. In the past couple of weeks, the UK and several countries in Europe, including Germany, France, and Switzerland, are experiencing a new wave. At least 12 countries geographically extending from Finland to Greece are experiencing new increases in cases, some quite marked, such as Austria, exceeding its pandemic peak. And Finland, with an 85% increase from the prior week. This is the sixth warning from the UK and Europe to the United States. We better take heed. The BA2 variant, Omicron 2, is gaining steam in the United States and is now accounting for more than 30% of the new cases. So,
oh my God.
Let's wrap it up and shut her down.
Yeah, well, Dr. Awardi said, yeah, the BA2 variant is here, but Omicron is still the number one variant, and it's
about to be displaced.
Well, it's more infectious, but not more lethal.
So what? What does that have to do with COVID policy? Mask it up.
Shut her down.
Clean all the surfaces. Put those idiot circles back down 6 feet apart.
Get away from me. Put the plexiglass up. It's never come down.
Still see plexiglass up.
My favorite was a shower curtain. I saw ones at a grocery store. Like, really? You think this is going to stop the vid? This thing?
All right. I know the lockdowns, all the research, including meta-analysis, suggests a very limited benefit as compared to the very big cost. But, you know, time to pull the kids out of school. Dr. Marty Makary joins us. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Bloomberg School of Public Health, chief medical advisor to Sesame Care, and author of the award-winning The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. Dr. Makary, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you.
So what about what Mr. Topol is writing about and the need to not get COVID complacent? It's time to ramp up our mitigations again.
Yeah, it's going to be important to wash your hands for two songs of Happy Birthday and get every little nook and remember that.
Hold on.
Oh my God, gallons. I remember that.
Hold on, wait.
Even mocked that on the morning show.
Wait a second. Wait, I want to write this down. We want to create a slide that we can post online so people we can remind.
Should
people.
We cancel Easter? Is this the Easter variant that people were worried about?
I'd cancel Easter for at least 5 years.
I mean,
we don't know what's going to happen. I think. Go ahead. Sorry.
No. Please. You were channeling Zeke Emanuel. Go ahead.
Well, look, the worst thing you can do in public health is keep restrictions on longer than they absolutely have to be on. You cannot keep your emergency powers that allow you to force people to do things when there's no longer a, you know, rationing at the brink of the doorsteps of hospitals like we saw in New York. And so what you're seeing now is that a lot of these folks got the keys to the kingdom and they don't want to give it back. And right now we are at levels that are basically where we're going to be forever. I mean, we always have respiratory viruses every year. Like, 10 to 25% of the public will get a virus every year. The study just came out of the Financial Times showing that COVID now has a infection fatality rate lower than influenza because of population immunity and Omicron's less severe. We're going to see an uptick in cases. We're seeing that in Europe. You know why? Because they're testing the hell out of everybody with no symptoms. So they're picking up incidental COVID cases. Tell me if any of these experts can tell you how many of these cases have symptoms, or if how many of these hospitalizations where they're seeing a small bump are for COVID versus an incidental COVID. If you test the population right now for meningococcus, you're going to find it in 10% of the noses of Americans. Doesn't mean they have the infection.
And when it comes to children, I mean, finally, our Illinois Department of Public Health director, who's resigned, by the way, I think today's her last day, actually. She finally came forward after 2 years and said more kids are dying from influenza and RSV than they are from COVID.
Yeah, if I remember, wasn't she the one who was basically saying, like, the schools have to be open? I think she said some good things, if I'm remembering correctly.
No,
you're not remembering
ours. Ours is Dr. Ezeke. Chicago Health Department Director, Dr. Awardi, said, yes, she wanted schools open. She was one of the first people to suggest
state,
that in Illinois.
At the state level, is there anybody other than Joseph Adapo who was saying that, you know, at any time in the recent past? I mean, I don't think there is.
Well, it'd be nice for them to apologize after these colossal mistakes. People need closure. You know, they've made tremendous sacrifices.
Apologize for loving too much, Dr. Makary? Apologize for caring too much? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think, you know, they have to apologize for the COVID zero approach. We did a terrible thing to doctors, by the way. Doctors subscribed, a lot of them, to groupthink. Now, I can tell you a large fraction of doctors reached out to me and gave me praise privately and said, gosh, I believe in this. Keep talking. I can't. I get bullied and threatened at my hospital. But most doctors just subscribe to whatever the CDC or Fauci said. And what we did is a terrible thing to doctors. We put them on a COVID zero mission. And the numbers just came out this morning on what's going on with substance abuse last year, way up from 2020. Way up. And we got the numbers last week on dementia, heart disease, and stroke from social isolation, up 30% heart disease and stroke, and up 50% for dementia. What do we do? What did we just do to people? It violates everything true about taking care of the whole person in medicine.
And just at one place at Northwestern, they have a sub place where they do mammograms and MRIs. They shut down for 3 months. Guess how many mammograms were canceled? Close to 8,000 mammograms were canceled. So you have to wait. Now you have to wait a year, year and a half to get an appointment back. So when are we going to see the effects of that, of the screenings that were lost, whether it be mammograms or colonoscopies or, you know, skin checks?
Some people don't want to see that data, by the way. We're seeing that in medicine right now, this sort of suppression of any analysis to evaluate the biggest public health intervention in history, which was to shut things down. We saw that with our Johns Hopkins analysis that was done that showed lockdowns really were counterproductive. And you know, I'm working on an analysis right now that compares Michigan to Sweden. They have identical populations, identical age distributions. Sweden had half the deaths of Michigan. As you know, Michigan had some of the strictest requirements. And Sweden was fairly reasonable with one or two mistakes they made early on.
Yeah, it took the Michigan State Legislature to finally intervene with respect to the Ava Perona of East Lansing there, Ms. Whitmer. There's no question about it. And so something else I wanted to ask you about, Albert Bolla, he's the CEO of Pfizer. And, we're the Pfizer generation, at least the kids are. He's got a book out, Moonstruck. I'm sure you've got a signed copy. He is saying that fourth booster is necessary. Fourth shot, you know, second booster, whatever, probably be an annual thing. Why? This is the same Albert Bolla who said Paxlovid, and you've talked about this with us as well, is a great therapeutic that if you get sick, Paxlovid knocks it out. So why do I have to get... I'm not going to, but why is he saying that you have to get an annual booster when you've got a effective therapeutic from the same company?
First of all, why is he making all the decisions for the country? Where's our CDC director? I mean, he's basically acting as a de facto director of the CDC, making these pronouncements on what should be recommended for everyday Americans. I mean, where's our CDC to say, hey, wait a minute, you're selling the medication? We'll make the recommendations. I mean, that's what I would say if I were head of the CDC. Second of all, if the vaccine's not working that well, change things up. You got to come up with an Omicron-specific vaccine because people are not up for a booster every Monday morning when they show up to work delivered by suppository by their boss. I mean, these people are completely out of touch with American.
What is the biggest mistake Dr. Fauci made, and when do you think he'll retire?
That's a good question. I mean, they tend to serve terms in our health agencies like the NIH, like they do like African presidents. You know, they serve like 50 years and they won't move despite many efforts to try to, you know, get some fresh young horses in there to give some new ideas. I think the biggest mistake in in my opinion, was ignoring natural immunity. The one that's most emotional, the mistake that was most emotional, and I just outlined the 10 biggest COVID mistakes on FoxNews.com. The most emotional one for me was separating families when they had dying loved ones, locking them out, not allowing them to say goodbye. That was the most cruel human rights violation. And all the experts in hospitals were complicit. They should apologize. That was a terrible thing we did to our country.
You know, we've had a couple of doctors that have essentially apologized to some of the great Barrington Declaration signatories, the Martin Kaldorffs and the Jay Bhattacharyas of the world. And I wonder, you were talking about all the your colleagues that were complicit in this or were privately like, I totally agree with you, Dr. Macri, but we never had this conversation. Those people, where are they now? Is there a lesson learned, or is it going to be mainly let's just walk past this and pretend it never happened, and we're still good people, and we're still healers, and we bear no responsibility for all the negative impacts of the policy choices we made?
So we've got some tribalism in medicine that's political. That is, doctors that are so political, they've lost their scientific objectivity, and even though the data now shows that things, they were wrong on natural immunity, they were wrong on the dosing interval between the first two doses, whatever the data has now sort of debunked, they will not admit anything. There's that group. But then there's a lot of doctors that have come around, realize the sort of colossal mistakes we've made, and those doctors are now more emboldened. They're speaking up, they're more public, and now it's good because, by the way, we have a wonderful profession in medicine. It has been tarnished significantly by the actions of a few small group of people that have made all the decisions on COVID and made catastrophic mistakes. So there's a lot of doctors now that are finally realizing, hey, you only live once. I'm going to speak my mind.
Well, that's encouraging. That's very encouraging because that's definitely part of what's required to learn the lessons and make sure the body politic learns the lessons of the last 2+ years. He's Dr. Marty Makary, professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Bloomberg School of Public Health, chief medical advisor to Sesame Care, and author of the award-winning The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. And we'll tweet out his piece from Fox News, The 10 Biggest COVID Mistakes and the Apology Owed to Americans. Dr. Macri, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you guys.
Thank you. And I look forward to reading your article about the comparisons between Michigan and Sweden. And the doctor joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Zelensky replaced Poroshenko. And Poroshenko is out and fighting for his country, as Zelensky is. Poroshenko had this to say in a recent interview by Sky News.
Mr. Poroshenko, we're nearly 3 weeks in, or your country is nearly 3 weeks into this war. Just briefly, if you can, do you have a better idea now than you did at the start what President Putin wants out of this?
Oh. Please, don't trust Putin. Please, don't be afraid of Putin. Because Putin go as far as we together allow them to go. And if we will be strong and united, we stop Putin. If you find out a compromise with Putin, Putin go further. Today, he has a compromise for demanding Ukrainian Crimea or Ukrainian Donbas. Tomorrow, he will demand from the Great Britain, Scotland. Day after tomorrow, he will demand from the United States, Alaska. Putin wants to destroy not only Ukraine, but the whole West.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is the argument that's being advanced to try to persuade the West to get more involved, more military resources, enforce a no-fly zone, maybe even go beyond that. That somehow Putin will be knocking on America's door if he's allowed to take Ukraine without Western intervention. and all the other dominoes as well. Then China's going to invade Taiwan and so forth. There's not really a lot to support that claim. But here's the more interesting thing. There's a good piece by Lee Jones at unheard.com about the elites in Ukraine. Again, as we talked about earlier in the show, I understand Zelensky is trying to do everything he can, get everything he can from everybody he can access to defend his country. But are we being led down a primrose path that somehow Ukraine can repel Putin, that somehow we can and should be in the business of helping Ukraine destabilize Putin? That's a possibility, ultimately leading to Putin being deposed. Is that a possibility? Or should we be in the business of trying to push detente and essentially adherence to the Minsk agreement of 2014 and 2015 between Russia and Ukraine, which proposed to settle the ongoing conflict in those breakaway republics, as they're termed by the Russians, in the Donbass region? Because that was never enforced. Zelensky went the other direction, loudly seeking membership in NATO and the EU. And the piece by Lee Jones actually gives the sort of the recent history of Ukraine, actually from its independence, which, you know, is only 30 years in the making, and how both the Russian faction, pro-Russian faction within Ukraine, when it was in power, say in the form of Yanukovych, as well as the pro-Western forces that were in power, like Poroshenko and then Zelensky, have essentially failed in their job to unify the country. And whether it's the Western reforms or the Russian toadyism, the country has basically existed to serve the oligarchs in much the same way that Russia did before the oligarchs fled to the West with their riches. It's just such a much more complicated picture than I think we're getting from everybody who's rushing to, from a good place of a desire to help, but maybe is sort of turning a blind eye to some of the pitfalls associated with certain levels of help. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Michael Goodwin, who's a New York Post columnist, Fox News contributor. Michael, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, guys. Thank you.
Do you share my concern about some of the rah-rah-ism around Zelensky and Ukraine with respect to U.S. involvement beyond providing weapons?
I think you make some good points. I think, the idea that we have to be careful here. We have to keep our interest front and center and not let sympathy lead us where we don't want to be. But I do think that at some, maybe the 30,000 feet view, that this is not really ultimately about Ukraine. It is about Russia. It is about China. It is about Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my piece last week where I wrote about the fact that Russia, the same Russia that's now bombing Ukraine into smithereens and creating the largest refugee crisis since World War II, that same Russia is our broker on the nuclear talks with Iran. Now, if Vladimir Putin is a war criminal, as Joe Biden said yesterday, why are we trusting him to negotiate on our behalf with Iran, because Iran won't talk to us? Now, what kind of deal do you make with somebody who won't talk to you?
It is inexplicable. I mean, it's like, as I said before the break, it's like a Peter Sellers movie. It would be a comedy if the stakes were not so high and if the matter wasn't so serious.
Right. And so I think, to me, that's ultimately what Ukraine is about. It is about the rise of the autocracies and the view, particularly from China, but also from Putin, that America is in decline. It's weak. It's divided. It's decadent. And it cannot get anything done anymore. It's not to be feared or respected.
Well, should we Should we sever the relationship with Putin in the Iran talks? Because if we don't have him, then who are we going to go to?
We shouldn't be talking to the mullahs at all. I mean, it would be the point. Why are we trying to, you know, resuscitate a glide path to a nuclear Iran, whether Russia is an intermediary or not? Isn't that the question?
Yes, and it's sort of the foolishness of the whole thing. The folly is revealed by having Russia as the go-between. But yesterday there were reports that we would move the Revolutionary Guards from the terror list. This is the group that fired the missiles in Iraq just last week.
Yeah.
I mean, we seem to be surrendering on every front. And that's my fear here, that we have lost that sense that we are, America is not just the leader of the free world, but we are what that word means fundamentally, that we created the free world largely through our founding, through our documents, through our constitutional guarantees of liberty, life, and the pursuit of happiness. I mean, this was a great experiment on mankind, among nations, among history. And so if we are losing that to the autocracies, and that doesn't mean we have to join every battle, send our troops into harm's way, as we've done sometimes foolishly, but it means we cannot ignore these events either. And I think, yes, we have to rally NATO and all of that, but fundamentally NATO doesn't exist without the United States. The creation of NATO was in response to the Soviet Union. So if we are going to do nothing while a Putin who wants to recreate the Soviet Union marches through those Soviet lands and gobbles them up, which is clearly his intent, is to go beyond Ukraine. He's made that clear. Then I don't know what we stand for. I don't know what NATO means, and I don't know what have we achieved if we're going to give it all back without a squabble even. So that's where that to me is what informs my view of what Ukraine is about.
Although if Ukraine were to fall, it doesn't necessarily follow that all the dominoes fall inexorably after them, does it? I mean, the point would be Ukraine fell in this hypothetical, but if you move into a NATO country, then you will have the full force of NATO in an offensive, I mean, in a defensive capacity, but in an offensive capacity as well, in terms of repelling any such incursion into Poland, Moldova, Romania, et cetera.
Yes, and that distinction, I think, is an important one, although Kamala Harris keeps seeming to forget that Ukraine is not in NATO. I mean, it's stunning that the Vice President of the United States keeps making that mistake. She must believe it, that Ukraine is in NATO. It's unbelievable. But I think there are ways to challenge this march without putting boots on the ground. So, that, for example, that's why I think Biden is absolutely right not to do a no-fly zone. I think it's impossible to stay out of the war if you do a no-fly zone, if only because so many of the Russian anti-aircraft batteries are actually in Russia and in Belarus. So you're quickly into a whole different level of combat. But I think you do everything else that you can to support this fight. They're fighting our foe. That's the way I look at it. We made the mistake in Vietnam of sending 500,000 troops and had to come home, you know, with our dead and with our pride and having missed the point of how to fight these proxy battles. And that, I think, is the mistake we're not making here. But we have to be careful not to go too far the other way and to keep our distance too far that our adversaries, Putin in this case, can feel free to gobble up, because that message then would be inspiring Iran. It would be inspiring China, certainly, on Taiwan. It would be inspiring North Korea. And who knows where else this message would pop up. And so I think it is important, as I wrote in my column just the other day, I think it's possible now that Ukraine could actually win this fight, not just not lose it badly, but actually win it. I mean, it is surprising how well their army has held up. I mean, the country has taken an awful pounding and those heartbreaking scenes. But I think the larger geopolitical issue here is that if you can deal Putin a defeat, however you want to measure that, then that sends exactly the opposite signal that a victory would send, not just about Ukraine, but China, Iran, that it would show that is NATO for real, that NATO is for real, that the United States is not ready to fold. And I think that would change some calculations. Well, it would save a lot of lives, and I think it would make the world a better place.
Yeah, and I mean, so this is Charlie Wilson's war redux. You know, we arm the Mujahideen. They repel the Russians out of Afghanistan. We understand, some of us did at least, that we're, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend sort of thing with respect to our arming the Mujahideen against the Russians. But the concern I have is that some of the people thinking about that Charlie Wilson's war era think that what we failed to do was rebuild Afghanistan. And then thus enters the Taliban and then the 20-year war that, you know, has just recently concluded. And I just wonder, and this is, you know, part of a conversation and an understanding, you know, if Americans realize that there are going to be some within the administration or really the foreign policy establishment of both parties in D.C. that will want us to finance the rebuilding of Ukraine after this and suggest that we have some, you know, stout of heart ally in the Zelensky government and whatever may come after Zelensky. And those are very different deals altogether. Those are very much open questions as far as I'm concerned.
I agree with you. And just because we made that mistake before, we don't have to make it again. Ukraine is certainly a more modern society than Afghanistan was and right. still is in terms of many of these ideas of rebuilding. I mean, Ukraine is a nation. Afghanistan is still not a nation state in the way we think of these things. It's still very tribal. And yes, there are problems in Ukraine, but it is not the same Ukraine it was 20 years ago even. It's only been independent for 30 years. And I think that in the more recent years, I mean, don't forget, this is where Hunter Biden went. I mean, that was the oligarch era. And you're right. I mean, that's Belarus still. And it is an issue throughout many of the former Soviet nations. All the more reason why there's a kind of turning point. Are they moving west or are they moving back under the Russian umbrella? Certainly Ukraine under Zelensky, but many of the people there, I mean, they are moving to Europe. I mean, they are European in their outlook. They are European in their orientations. So this is a great case for us to bring them into our fold eventually. I mean, the EU, certainly they will be able to join the EU. NATO is another issue, but I do think that this is a test. This is an important test. And just because we've made mistakes before doesn't mean we have to make them all again this time. We have learned. And that's why I say I think the reluctance, the refusal to do the no-fly zone is smart. It does cross the line and put you inevitably into a military conflict with Russia that you haven't chosen to do. You backed into it by accident. That's the mistake of these past wars.
But what if he uses chemical weapons? Then would that change everything?
It would certainly raise the stakes. I think it would be a different issue. But no, I don't think it would change everything. I don't think it would. I don't think I would wake up the next morning and say, now we've got to do a no-fly zone. No, I don't think it would create that kind of reaction among the government or among NATO states. I think it would be just another example of his brutality and how there's no end to it, which in fact calls for us to do even more short of sending American troops or getting entangled directly with Russia. Look, I think Biden has been much too cautious. I mean, he needs to be embarrassed and shamed every step of the way to do more. And I think you go back to the beginning. There was no deterrence on Putin to do this. I mean, for months he built up the troops and nobody, an invasion is coming, as though that was going to stop him. I mean, it's Tony Blinken and Biden, and they live in Samantha Power. It's like you're going to be at an Upper East Side Manhattan dinner party and someone's going to wag their finger at you. I mean, that's not what Putin cares about, but that's how they think. That's how John Kerry thinks. Oh, the world of nations is not going to like this. There is no world of nations. It's America. It's power. It's all about power. And for people like Putin, you either have it and you use it or you don't. And he's willing to use it. And so someone's got to be on the other side to say, no, that can't happen. We're not going to let that happen. That is the role of the United States. That is the role of NATO. We are not alone, but if we don't do it, nobody will.
He is Michael Goodwin, New York Post columnist, Fox News contributor. Michael, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you both.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.